thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 17 for the 14th of December, 2007. Can you hear me now? I'm Dan Cohen. And it's a holiday spectacular here on the podcast this week. We're back once again with Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan. How you doing?
Okay, pretty good. And our continuing story, as we usually begin the podcast for new listeners, with our news roundup. And I guess is this the final chapter of the Facebook privacy advertising saga here?
Let's hope so.
You know, it's interesting. I noticed a lot of at least friends on my Facebook friends, but there was a rush toward the exit, I think, around 2 weeks ago in our last podcast, with this Facebook beacon telling all your friends what movie tickets you're buying. And then this week I noticed a lot of people had status messages like, okay, we're going to give it one more chance. And I guess the news here is that Facebook really had to back down. I think they tried to hedge a little bit by, for those who are just joining the newscast, about a month ago, Facebook added several new advertising features that sent news stories from outside vendors, so Overstock.com and Fandango were a couple that I had seen, which is a movie ticket site. And if you bought something there, they would know, because they were linked into Facebook's database, that you were a member of Facebook, and then it would give you this little message saying, hey, do you mind if we send this to your Facebook account? And actually, at first, this was very subtle, and if you didn't do anything, it would automatically send it to your account, and you'd have these commercial messages or endorsements that you'd made for these services or products. And they sort of stepped down after some pressure from MoveOn.org and other places that really put it on the sort of national news. And so that you had to click OK, and it would give you several chances to click OK. And if you didn't click OK, the default wasn't that it sent it to your news feed. But then finally they realized that that still wasn't enough, and I think all three of us are members of the Facebook group Facebook Users Against Facebook Beacon, which was this program that we discussed. And so finally they backed totally down, and there is a one-click opt-out for this Facebook Beacon program. And so I thought maybe we'd just mention, the three of us would just discuss actually how to do this if you'd like to be to stay on Facebook but want better privacy. You need to click on, they've still kind of buried this, which is a little bit annoying, but I guess Google and other places do this as well with their privacy settings. And we have another privacy story coming up in the news roundup. But quickly on Facebook, click on privacy, and which is in the upper right, one of the links in the upper right on your homepage in Facebook. And then you'll see a link that they've now added called external websites. So it's a new privacy setting. And you click on external websites, and then there's a single checkbox that says, don't allow any websites to send stories to my profile. And you click that, and you've then opted out of Facebook Beacon. So those of you who are interested, that's where to find it. And you know, maybe they've forestalled. I guess, Mills, you were speculating, or Tom, you were speculating last time in our Facebook story that eventually people would find something new. Maybe this pushes that date back of massive abandonment toward the next social networking site for a few more months. Have you guys set this privacy setting, or
this, I have definitely set that privacy setting.
Yeah, me too. And I think you're absolutely right. I think one more chance is the word on this. I'll give them one more chance.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the problem is they need to make money now. I mean, they're past the growth phase, and they need to justify this incredible valuation for the company. And so, obviously, I mean, they have to find their AdSense. I mean, if you think about the growth of Google, Google was a nice little grad student project, and then it was a widely used search engine, but it wasn't, you know, worth anything really. I mean, it wasn't worth the hundreds of billions of dollars it's worth now until they figured out AdSense. So, you know, at some point they're going to have to figure out some way of making money, and a lot of money. And so I assume that invading privacy is a good way to do this.
Yes, they have to figure out, as Rupert Murdoch put it when he bought MySpace, they have to figure out a way to monetize their traffic.
Right. I know. Yeah. Are we allowed to use words like that as academics?
Sure.
yeah, I've been wondering this over the past week. I was up at Beinecke Library, and I was thinking of you know, starting off the podcast by saying hi to all the incredibly nice and smart people up at the Beinecke Library. I was wondering, can I give them a shout out? Is that okay on an academic podcast to give a shout out? I'm not sure.
I think it's all right. I think you shout away.
A shout out. Well, I'll give a shout out then to my wonderful hosts up at Yale, Tom and Kathleen and Rebecca and Mike and Lisa and Chris and all the other people that I met up there. It was terrific, and some old friends as well. So. A shout out. I hope this doesn't deny me tenure to use colloquial terms from the radio universe. Okay, so Facebook taken care of, I guess, for now. We'll see what Mark Zuckerberg comes up with next in that genius 23-year-old mind of his, diabolical mind of his. And, you know, interestingly enough, this week we saw that other networks, other social networks, I think, are sort of trying to take advantage of what's going on here. And LinkedIn, which is, I think, Tom, you had talked about the history of social networks, and which, to my mind, was exactly right. It was sort of Friendster, and then LinkedIn was big for a while, and then everyone abandoned LinkedIn for Facebook. But now they're back. Do you want to talk about this a little bit and what you see happening here?
Well, it is interesting with LinkedIn that it was around for a while, and I think people got really annoyed by it because they kept getting, you know, invitations to LinkedIn, and I think the moment wasn't quite right, where this was maybe I don't know, 2003, 2004, in that area. People were getting messages and invitations for LinkedIn, and I think people didn't really quite know what to do with them. Like, well, what is this LinkedIn thing? Why do I need to be a member of this? And they kind of vaguely understood it was for networking purposes, but I just don't think it caught fire because it was maybe a little too early. I also think it was targeting kind of the wrong audience. LinkedIn went first after working professionals, which again, people who are a little older, and this was a little ahead of its time. So you get the combination of someone who's old and something that's really new. And I think it just kind of fizzled. But all of a sudden, it appears that LinkedIn is growing again. And I know personally, I've been getting tons of messages from invitations. And I still have a LinkedIn account from way back when. But I'm getting now tons of messages again, invitations to you know, friend people on LinkedIn. And I think it's in large part due to the popularity of Facebook that all the kids got onto Facebook, and then the people who are maybe a little bit past being a kid got onto Facebook. And then they sort of thought, well, maybe I should take a look at this other product, which is more maybe more designed towards an older audience, a more professional audience. And so people started looking at LinkedIn, and now it really is back in the news. Is now this week that LinkedIn is in fact growing faster than Facebook, and so it's
that kind of surprised me.
Yeah, it, definitely surprising. And the other thing that was announced was that LinkedIn, like Facebook, is developing an API, an application development platform, to allow third-party application developers to build programs that people can use on their LinkedIn page, you know, like as Facebook allows you to play Scrabble and with Scrabulous and allows you to compare movie tastes with your friends, LinkedIn is going to allow people to build applications, presumably that allow you to, I don't know, share CVs or do things that maybe professionals and people who are a little bit older.
Right. Well, you could totally see, you know, enterprise kinds of applications. I mean, and we use these on our campus. Like we have a enterprise grade calendaring system for all the administrators. So, you know, they set up their appointments on this sort of publicly available calendar, and you could see putting that into your LinkedIn page. You know, meeting listings, things like that. It's just one example.
You could almost see it extending out to become a kind of project management platform where groups of people who are working together, this is where they go to share messages, share information, connect with partners, and build out projects in the way that we here at Center for History and New Media use 37 Signals Basecamp, or people use Microsoft Project or those other kinds of project management platforms. You could almost see, because once you have all the people there and all of their information there, and then maybe their calendar information and other information, you could see how then you can start to actually work on this kind of a platform and not just play in the way that we do on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everyone's been touting the Facebook applications that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg talks about the 8,000 applications that have been made. If you go look at the directory, the number of those that are, you know, I don't know, maybe this is a bad way of describing them, but serious applications, in other words, that aren't about turning people into zombies or sending them a fake pizza or throwing sheep at them. I mean, the number there that can be really used in, you know, let's call it the administrative part of the campus are very, very small. And, you know, interestingly, when I was up at Beinecke, I got a question about, you know, well, there was a lot of discussion at the Digital Library Federation meeting in Philly in November, which I unfortunately couldn't make. And everyone was saying, well, shouldn't we be placing our academic applications within Facebook? And my point on this was, you know, is it really the place where people are going for work or academic related pursuits? And my feeling is it's not. You know, our students are going there, you know, to find out where the next keg party is or to see who's dating whom. And I just don't think the students want to, you know, have little pop-ups in that about their library books being overdue. You know, I know a lot of libraries are pursuing this, and maybe there's something there. And, you know, I have to admit, since I'm going to, you know, we're throwing stones in glass houses here, maybe, but, you know, we'll probably build some Facebook applications for Zotero. But I'm just not sure that it's the place for it. And I guess LinkedIn, you know, they've got a more buttoned down brand. And even though I really disliked LinkedIn when I first got on it, and I've desperately tried to leave, I could see a role for it as the kind of serious networking place, you know, the serious social network versus the fun Facebook platform. Okay, well, I guess we'll compare the numbers on this and see where people end up. I'm probably still not going back onto LinkedIn, but I do get invitations all the time. Okay, well, our next story has to do with privacy, as I mentioned at the beginning. And this has to do with one of the, I guess we could call it major search engines. I mean, they have a little bit under 5% of the total American search market. It's ask.com. For those who remember, they used to be Ask Jeeves, and they were supposed to answer natural language questions, and that never worked out that well. And indeed, my understanding is that their search engine really uses Google for doing most of the sort of behind-the-scenes search technology. But it is, you know, a semi-popular site, and I guess they've tried to distinguish themselves, and this is sort of interesting from a campus perspective and a privacy perspective as well, by now having a serious push toward making sure that what you say, what you search for, is private. And you know, I thought this was going to be a little bit more obvious, but if you go to the Ask homepage, which has been recently redesigned, it's a very clean page, and I think a really nice design as well. But if you go there, at the very top, there's a grayed out link that says Ask Eraser, and when you click on that, it's just a one click thing, your screen darkens up and there's this little query that says, do you want to turn on Ask Eraser? And it says that if you do this, it's a privacy feature and that all of the things that you do on Ask will be deleted from their servers. So, you know, if you have a very private search to do and you don't want Google to know about it, and indeed they record all of your searches and link it up with your IP address, and if you have a Google Docs or Gmail account, they'll link it up to your, you know, that stuff as well, at least for 18 months is my understanding, and then they throw it out. But Ask has this feature now where you can totally privatize what you do there. Do you think this is going to be effective? Is this something that, you know, we should be encouraging people to use Ask over Google because of this privacy setting? Mills, what do you think about this?
Well, I don't know that people need to be encouraged. I think it's really a question of whether people care. And if they do care, then they need to know about this. Because there are an awful lot of people who want to maintain a fair amount of privacy in their online lives, and those seem like contradictory terms, but privacy and online. But it is, you know, I think it's a welcome development because I don't think that large corporations like Google need to know every request for information that somebody makes. And you know, as we've seen just in this discussion of Beacon, you know, it gets put to all sorts of annoying uses by companies like Facebook or others. So I think it's a welcome development, and I think I would be surprised if Google ever offers an eraser, because I don't know that the pressure in the marketplace is so strong that, you know, the vast majority of Google users are going to migrate to Ask just because they can have this kind of privacy block.
I think it's an interesting development in that, and I think Ask has been doing fairly well with this, or at least they've had some good ideas. I think Microsoft and Yahoo's strategy for competing against Google has been recently to kind of out-Google Google and to do search better, and to kind of offer the same range of features that Google offers, and to somehow beat them in terms of marketing, or I'm not sure how they plan to take market share away from Google by just doing what Google is doing. Ask, I think, has had a different business model where they've been trying to add features that Google doesn't have, and I think this is that they're trying to create. And I think Ask understands that it's never going to be the big dog. I think what they want to be is they want to be a niche player, and I think there's a lot of room for, you know, right now they only maybe have 5% of the market, but if they got up to 15% of the market, that's a pretty big business.
Yeah, that's a lot of search queries.
Yeah, and they can do a lot. So they have this privacy option, which is a feature that Google doesn't have. They have a neat feature which allows you to kind of – they basically have a delicious bookmarks, a social bookmarking platform kind of built into their search results, so you can save links and annotate those links directly through the search results, which is kind of a cool thing. They have a very, very good maps search and display results on geolocated display results. They're trying to do something different, and so I think Ask is definitely something to watch for these new developments.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, you know, it's probably a marginal bump up for them, but you know, and I think it just to have it out there, it sort of puts pressure on others to say, hey, well, do you have this feature? I'd probably agree with Mills. You know, I think the number of people interested in privacy, unfortunately, as the Facebook, you know, Facebook group, the Facebook users against Facebook Beacon, I think it's only 70,000 people, and there are 50 million Facebook users. So, you know, it's hard to know how much this will have an impact, but it's an interesting differentiating feature. And I agree that I don't think at this point anyone's going to top Google on just search quality. That's going to be really hard. And the fact that there's that upper right-hand box in Firefox and Safari and other places that the default is Google, someone's going to have to actively switch to Ask. So things like this, you know, it could make a difference. I think it's instructive. I think it's instructive for, you know, for us as we run some local search engines on, you know, on our, let's say, 9/11 collection to think about, hey, what's happening to these searches? You know, we have logs, we have server logs. What's happening to those? And I think it just anything that raises the kind of privacy issues, I think, is healthy in terms of, you know, discussing, you know, on campus what happens with our information. So, you know, I think it's a good development, and I give them some kudos for at least trying it out. Go ahead, Muscle.
And I would say that although it does appear that Ask is using the Google algorithm, they do return different results, because I just ran a simple test of searching Mills Kelly in Google and then searching Mills Kelly in Ask, and the third link that comes up in Google if you search just Mills Kelly without the quotation marks is quite interesting. The headline says, "A lot of different girls talking openly about naughty stuff," which I can guarantee is not me. However, that does not come up in the Ask search, so maybe I need to switch to the Ask.com search engine.
Ah, very interesting. Huh. Okay, well, maybe search quality does matter after all. Well, our final story this week in our news roundup gets back to podcasting. And we talked about, and I think I threw out last week a link to in Digital Campus 16 for OpenCast, which is an initiative started by UC Berkeley, but joined by, I think, a couple of dozen other universities, where they're trying to build an open source platform to make it easier for professors to podcast. And this week in the New York Times, they had a story about, I guess, Berkeley wasn't the only one to think about this. There are indeed companies who are rushing into this market. And University of Central Florida, for instance, is using a lecture capture system from Tegrity. Oh, gosh, what an awful name that is. Tegrity. I'm sure they paid a name consultant $100,000 for that one. And several other universities signed on. It's not cheap. I mean, these are expensive licenses to use some of the software. In fact, Tegrity says that their annual fees run from $25,000 to more than $100,000 to have campus-wide installations. I guess this includes some hardware installations as well to record these things. But is the age of the in-person lecture coming to an end? Mills, you've discussed this recently. Should we be worried as actual professors who give lectures that we expect students to come to rather than looking at their iPod, their video iPod while they're on the treadmill?
And are we contributing to the downfall of the lecture with this podcast?
Yes, are we?
You know, I think we're entering into a kind of mixed attendance, mixed media age on this, where there are an awful lot of students who are going to continue to show up for class. But if the faculty member is capturing the entire class and putting it up as a podcast, then attendance is going to fall way off. And there's all sorts of empirical research to show that this is what happens, is that in some classes attendance drops down to near zero if the students know that they can just watch or listen to the podcast. And so, you know, this semester I put up a series of podcasts from one of my lecture courses where I put up just snippets of lectures, you know, 15 minutes here, 20 minutes there. And then at the end of the semester, on the last day, I put up the full lectures for exam review purposes. And so, the students were very happy about that, because there were class sessions that they had missed and they wanted to go back and download that particular class. But I just honestly, I wasn't going to put up the whole class, because I wanted them to actually come to class. Otherwise, I'd be kind of lonely there in the classroom just talking to myself and my microphone.
Right. Well, I guess since it's the end of the semester, should we tell all of our students that the Digital Campus Podcast is not a substitute for live interaction with your professor or other students in your class, nor is it a substitute for your final project and exams, which I expect via email shortly.
Well, I the thing that bugs me about this, I think, is the fact that these universities are contracting with another, you know, big technology vendor or set of technology vendors to do something that really could be done on campus without commercial products. I mean, and I think we should be teaching our faculty to do some of this on their own. Now, I understand that, you know, not everybody's as tech savvy as we are, but like, it's really not that hard to do. And with a little bit of training for the faculty could do, I think, a lot of this on their own. And with a set of free tools like the things that Berkeley offers, or even the things that iTunes offers, which are generally free, I think I'm worried that we're going to get into a situation with podcasting and kind of classroom multimedia that we're in with course management software, where you've got a couple big vendors who provide a set of technologies which really you could get elsewhere for free. So like Blackboard made a big announcement this week or recently that the new version of Blackboard offers wikis and blogs. And I'm sure they're going to raise their prices for those services. I'm sure they're going to sell those services to campuses. And, you know, we've talked about it on the podcast before. You can go out and build a wiki very easily for free on the web with a bunch of hosted wiki services like PBWiki and Wet Paint and others. You can do the same with a blog. You can go to Blogger or Tumblr or any number of free blogging services, and it's just as easy as using Blackboard. So I'm a little worried that we're getting, you know, this is just another place for CIO offices to spend money when they should be directing faculty and students to free services that compete very well with the commercial services.
Well, and the other thing I would say about that is that if the University of Florida, was it, Dan, that's doing
yeah,
this?
University of Central Florida.
University of Central Florida is spending $100,000 a year or a semester on a program like this, then with a vendor like this, then there is going to be a lot of pressure on faculty members to use it.
And
I think that's not really appropriate, because an awful lot of people don't want to open up their classrooms in this way. I mean, I'm one of those people who does, but there are also lots of people who don't. So I think the pressure is going to be a real problem.
Sure is. So if Facebook isn't the right place for academics and professors and libraries to place their scholarly applications and notices and these sorts of things. And maybe it is. I guess the jury's still out. But, I think the thinking around this roundtable on Digital Campus is that there's another technology that all students have and that they use daily, just like Facebook. And that, of course, is the cell phone. And there have been a lot of interesting developments this fall that I think are making the cell phone a very interesting platform for scholarly and library and museum pursuits. I know I was at a museum recently where they actually had a phone number that you could dial up. You didn't have to rent those little audio recording players to carry with you around the galleries, but you could actually dial up a number on your cell phone. Fantastic use of the cell phone for scholarly purposes. And this fall, of course, we saw the release of the iPhone, and we know that upcoming in January, they're probably going to announce the 3G iPhone, a faster version of the iPhone. There'll be a software development kit, or SDK, that's coming out soon for people. In the same way that people can write applications for Facebook, they'll be able to write native applications for the iPhone. And, of course, hot on the heels of that, Google released Android, which is out now, which is their open source platform for cell phones that cell phone vendors can use to write their own applications. Outside application developers can write applications for Android that will run on a variety of different handsets. And Google has done some other things, like if you have a mobile phone that can access Google Maps, so for instance a BlackBerry or anything else that would run Java, they have, so that includes, actually it includes Windows Mobile and Nokia phones that have the Symbian operating system as well. So a wide array. Actually, it's not quite out for the iPhone yet, but I think they're working on this. But if you do have a mobile phone that can access Google Maps, you can actually see your location on that map. And and at the same time, Verizon has talked about opening up their network to new phones and new applications. AT&T piled on and said they were going to do the same thing. And Mills, you've theorized about this, about the possible educational uses for cell phones. I mean, again, this technology that, you know, really far more than computers is affecting the way that students communicate with each other, and they're carrying it around all the time. Do you want to talk about some of these possibilities and where you see this going? This clearly is going to be the big story for 2008, the use of cell phones on campus and the use of applications on cell phones.
Yeah, I think that the cell phone has a lot more possibility than the e-book reader to transform the way that educational content is delivered, shared, managed by students and their professors, because the cell phone is so ubiquitous and so multi-purpose now. And with this, you know, throwing open the possibility of third-party application development is really going to change things, I think, because, you know, right now, for me, it's kind of funny to talk about this because I force my students to turn off their phones when they come into class. But I could imagine a day not very far off where, I'm providing them with educational content access, whether it's a podcast or just a series of images that I want them to think about or something like that, and they can pull it down to their phone. Now, it used to be that phone screens were so small that would be kind of ridiculous. But now, I mean, if you look at the iPhone screen, the BlackBerry screen, some of the bigger sort of sidekick screens, they can, you know, not only can they read a lot of text and look at images that way, they do. And, you know, also we're seeing phones increasingly being multimedia devices, showing video or holding sound files. And so, you know, as a one-stop device, I think the phone has a lot more possibility for educational purposes. I think one of the things that's going to be really interesting to see is whether third-party developers are able to come up with a way for phones to also be instant response devices in these classroom instant response environments. Right now, you have to pick up a clicker when you walk in the door of the classroom that has your ID code on it, but that seems kind of crazy if you can just do it with your cell phone. And
yeah, Bill, do you want to explain this a little bit more, how these clickers work for people who don't know this classroom technology?
Yeah, it's a really interesting technology that allows students to interact directly with information on the screen in the room. So, for instance, a friend of mine who teaches chemistry at Notre Dame, he, in a very large classroom environment, a guy named Dennis Jacobs, who was Case Professor of the Year a couple of years ago, Dennis puts up a problem on the screen and with possible answers, and the students have to do two things. They have to click in there with a little, it looks like a TV clicker in many ways, click in their answer, you know, is it A, B, C, or D, and their confidence level in their answer. And so then Dennis's software then projects on the screen how the students in the room have answered, but he doesn't say what the correct answer was. Then he tells them that they have to turn to the person sitting next to them and talk to them. Each person gets to talk for 1 minute about why they answered the way they did and why they had the confidence level that they did. And then they answer a second time, and what, again, indicating their confidence level. And what Dennis's research on this has shown is that just that 1 minute or 2 minute interaction between students in a large lecture hall significantly increases, I mean really significantly increases, not only the number of students who get the answer correct, but also whose confidence in their answer goes up. And then there's a lot of research to show that the more confident you are about information and your knowledge of it, the more that information stays with you. So he's able to substantially improve the pass rates in his introductory chemistry course, which is usually a, you know, sort of a weed out course for pre-meds, from close to 30% of the students failing the class to fewer than 10% of the students failing the class. And so, you know, it's really changed the way that introductory chemistry is taught. And especially in big lecture hall environments like that, it really provides the students with a lot of useful interaction opportunities. So right now that's done through a proprietary system with a specialized clicker like your TV remote. But I think within a year or two, that's just going to happen with people's phones.
Yeah, you could imagine an iPhone app right now that would, do this. I mean, you just have to create a website and with some interactive element and some checkboxes and have it tabulated on the server side. So I could see that completely happening. Tom, you've also been looking into some possible uses for cell phones, in the field for teaching, at historic sites, battlefields and things like that in Virginia. Do you want to mention that a little bit?
Yeah, I think I've talked a little bit about this on the podcast before, but what really excites me about the cell phone as a platform for information is that it's so portable that it has the potential to allow people to access information resources that are located out in the landscape, not just you know, where they happen to be, but as they move around. So one of the things we've tried to get funding for time and again, and just I think if I can be frank, through the short-sightedness of the Virginia Department of Transportation, haven't been able to secure funding for, is a project to deliver historical marker content directly to people's cell phones, either while they're in their car or while they're out walking around. So there are these historic markers that are located all around the state, and you know, people drive by them at 50 miles an hour, or they don't even know that they're there. Your cell phone knows where you are, and by tapping into that information, that geolocation information, which we can now do, we can deliver this content that's out there, that's been produced out in the landscape, directly to people as they're passing through those locations. So that kind of location-specific information is really possible now with cell phones. We've also talked about with for instance, the people up at Antietam Battlefield, about providing similar kinds of information to people as they walk across the battlefield. So delivering texts and images to people as they walk around the battlefield, images of those locations, texts about the locations where they happen to find themselves. But I think there's also a possibility, because it really is not just a delivery platform, it's actually an interactive platform. I think there are some really interesting possibilities for allowing especially students to interact with the historical and cultural landscape. So one of the things I would really love to do, and I've thought about, and Mills and I have talked about a bunch, is, for instance, a scavenger hunt of sorts on the National Mall here in Washington. So students would have their cell phones. They might be broken up into groups, and they would have to spread out across the mall with chaperones or teachers or whomever, and they would, as they walked through different places, they would get clues, and the clues they would get them via text message or on a mobile web browser. And as they got these clues, they would have to provide some answers or some feedback, and they would get more clues. And that cell phone, those cell phone messages would circulate them around the mall in a kind of productive and educational way. So, I mean, I think there's all kinds of opportunities for this, and I think it's been very, very hard to get people to, especially funders, to see the potentials here. But I think especially the iPhone is going to make the difference in that funding arena, because I think all of a sudden with the iPhone, the kind of non-tech savvy, the ordinary, the general public has sort of seen, wow, there's a lot that can be delivered via cell phone. Look at all the things you can do with this platform. Yeah. They've started to see it not as a phone anymore, but as a platform, a computing platform, because the iPhone with its beautiful interface makes that so clear. And I think with the iPhone we're really turning a corner. Although I don't have one myself, I think it does open up the eyes of people who matter in this area.
And I would just say that, you know, I'm teaching a course in our January term in Prague, Vienna, and Budapest, and I would kill for what Tom just described, because the whole point of the course is how national identities are constructed in public space. And so the students have to go to various sites of memory, museums, galleries, statues, whatever, in these three cities, and to be able to have a whole lot of content coded in that they can access via their cell phone right away, and then a platform where they can create content and add it to some sort of collaborative project of the class, that would be really different from the way I have to teach the class right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think from what both of you are saying, you know, you need to think about the cell phone as a new kind of platform with new possibilities, because it is mobile, and it is in your pocket, and you know, I think we discussed in the news roundup the Tegrity podcasting system, but really, isn't that just taking? It's just taking the lecture and putting it on a mobile device. I mean, on an iPod or a Zune or whatever. But really, what's exciting about the cell phone here is that it opens up all these other possibilities of location-based delivery. I mean, audio, visual, communications between two people who have cell phones. And really, if we're going to be, you know, thinking about this, we need to think about the wide variety of possibilities that the cell phone opens up, and not just, you know, one angle, you know, the audio, or just, you know, some web page that's showing up on a mobile device, that we need to take advantage of the full range of capacities that the cell phone has.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that I think people are starting to see about the cell phone that maybe they haven't seen before is that it's not just an output device. It's not just a device for outputting audio and in some cases some kind of rough video. It's an input device as well. Your cell phone now has a camera in it, and oftentimes, most of the time now, a video camera in it. And your cell phone increasingly has a keypad on it. And so it's now not just a technology for delivering content. It's a technology for producing and receiving content and uploading content. And I think that shift is going to be a necessary one to move. That shift in thinking is to move the cell phone into this new arena.
Yeah, and you know, I was struck when Steve Jobs gave all of his hype about the iPhone, that one of the things, you know, he said was that they were going to prevent this from happening with the iPhone, because your phone was a phone, and it needed to be, you know, if you had an emergency, you needed to be able to make a call and things like that. Well, the fact is, this is wrong-headed thinking, which Jobs is not often guilty of, but I mean, people want it to be more than a phone. And the fact that so many people hack their iPhones right away and turn them into more than a phone shows just how wrong that is. I mean, I think Tom's absolutely right that these devices are not phones anymore. Their phone is their primary purpose, perhaps, but that's not just what they're there for.
If I could just make one more comment and give our listeners something to keep their eyes on, too. I think in January, there's going to be a large spectrum auction. The FCC is going to be auctioning off the 700 megahertz wireless spectrum, which is, I think, part of the old UHF spectrum. And the rumor has it, and this is a pretty strong rumor, I think, is that Google is going to make a bid for that spectrum. And there's a lot of speculation about what Google's going to do if they secure that spectrum, but essentially it will put them in direct competition with the cell phone operators. And basically it will make Google a cell phone operator. And what people suspect is that Google is going to actually give away wireless service and support it like they do, like they support their search service, with advertising. But that 700 megahertz spectrum is a particularly rich area of the spectrum, and they'll be able to deliver broadband wireless, and people suspect they'll do it for free. And I think that will change things as well. If you're able to, as soon as it doesn't cost anything anymore to get broadband access on your mobile device, that's going to open things wide up. So definitely something to keep your eye on over the holiday break and into January.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens to that. It's a strange auction that's going to take a couple of months, but it will start in January. And you know, even if Google doesn't succeed, what's interesting here is that just by the fact of the sort of them wading into this world of the wireless spectrum, they've effectively forced Verizon and AT&T and others, who are definitely going to bid on this, to follow at least a couple of principles for opening up at least this spectrum to any device and application. They didn't quite get everything that they wanted to. They talked to the FCC and said, well, you know, we'll bid at least $4.6 billion if you operate this spectrum licensing under certain open principles. They didn't get all the principles. So, for instance, one of the principles that they tried to push for was that the winner of the auction had to sell sub-licenses for the spectrum to any bidder effectively at some reasonable cost. And, you know, Verizon is not in that business of buying something for a lot of money and then giving it away at cost or slightly there above. But, you know, I think regardless, we're going to end up with a very interesting, you know, by the middle of next year, I think the landscape for cellular technology is really going to change. And I think, you know, with Android coming out and next generation of the iPhone, and just more people using these things, I think it really will have changed, and we'll need to look at again sort of all these possibilities that Tom and Mills, you've described so well, that I think there's tremendous possibilities for both the classroom and outside the classroom more generally. It's time once again for Picks of the Week. Tom, what do you have for us this episode?
Well, if I could get a little plug in here for a project that I'm working on, we've actually got a big announcement this week in the Omeka project. Omeka is our web publishing platform for cultural institutions that we're developing here at the Center for History and New Media. It's a free and open source platform for building online exhibitions. Essentially, and I've talked about this before a little bit on the podcast, but essentially it's a piece of software that's easy to use, easy to install, and it's designed to make it as easy to launch an online exhibition or an online collection as it is to launch a WordPress blog. And we use the WordPress metaphor a lot in the Omeka project, and we're trying to make it just as easy to do online publishing of cultural and historical and educational resources as it is to post blog posts. So Omeka, it's actually had its initial private beta release in late September, and there's a kind of an invite only release out there now. And it's currently in Release Candidate 3. Release Candidate 4 comes out actually today, and that has several new features, the biggest one being a huge improvement in speed. But we'll also have a new Dropbox plugin, and that will allow people who have large collections to upload things in batches. Essentially, it's a batch upload function, which will make it easier for people to transition from whatever they're using now, or if they just have stuff lying around on their hard drive, to start using Omeka. So RC4 comes out today, and it's, as I said, it's only an invite-only beta now. But listeners of Digital Campus, if you send an email to feedback@digitalcampus.tv. That's our email address, right, Dan?
Yep. feedback@digitalcampus.tv.
Mm-hmm. We can get you off the waiting list right away, and into the test group. So that's at omeka.org if you're interested, and please shoot us an email if you want to be a beta tester.
Sounds great. Congratulations on RC4 to the whole Omeka team. It's really amazing software, and I can say that as someone who's not working on it at all, but is admiring it from down the hallway. Congratulations, Tom, to you and the team.
Thanks,
Mills, what do you have for this week?
Mine is actually a blog. It's a scholarly blog called Brainstorm that lives on the Chronicle Review website, and it's actually a multi-author blog, but the reason I found it in the first place is my good friend Stan Katz up at Princeton is one of the contributors. And what's really nice about it is that these are the contributors to this blog are really senior people in the field who are thinking really carefully about the future of higher education. People like Stan, Stephen Joel Trachtenberg, the former president of George Washington University, Dan Greenberg, who was with Stan at the ACLS, Gina Barreca, a really important scholar in gender studies. So it's a really, really well-written blog. And for those interested in where higher education is going over the next 10 years or so, it's definitely a must-read.
Great. I'll have to add that to my feed reader. Sounds like a good find. Well, for this week, actually, I have a link that is probably helpful related to our cell phone story. So one of the things that people don't realize is that you can actually get podcasts on your phone. And so, I think this is really interesting because as much as podcasting has quote unquote gone mainstream, there's still very few people who subscribe to podcasts. And it is sort of a complicated process, even within iTunes, of sort of understanding what's going on and what it is. But since the summer, actually, Digital Campus has had a phone number that you can call. It's 289-466-5003. And when you call that number, you'll actually hear our latest podcast on your phone. And we've done this through a service called Podlines, podlinez.com. And what I'd like to advocate here is anyone who's listening from the museum or library world that has an exhibit, what you can do is really easily set up one of those audio walking tours using this service and the cell phones that are in people's pockets. So you just go to podlinez.com. First, you'll need a blog or some other RSS feed for your audio. And we can talk about that another time. But if you go to, you know, blogger.com or any of these major commercial services that allow you to set up a blog, you can set up a blog with audio. And essentially, you now have a podcast. All a podcast is audio plus an RSS feed on something like a blog. So indeed, we're just using some basic blogging software, and we just attach the audio to that file, and it becomes a podcast. Now, as long as you have a podcast, you go to Podlines and just type in the URL for your podcast, and it will give you a free telephone number like the one I just gave you for that podcast. And you don't have to have a podcast every week. Again, it could just be for an exhibit that lasts for 6 months or a year or even permanently. You could have one audio file. And this would be a way for $0 for you to have a phone number that is essentially an audio feed for that exhibit. So I think this is a really easy, cheap way to try out doing something with cell phones. You can then, you know, have a little sign with your number in the lobby, and people can go in and listen to their cell phones and see what your curator has to say about the exhibit that you have in-house. And I think this service could be used for a number of other purposes as well. But again, podlines.com. Well, Tom and Mills, next week is our big first annual Bonanza wrap-up of the year, our 2007 big stories of the year. So we're hoping that all of our current listeners, and hopefully many more, will join us in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.